Live coverage of President Gorbachev's historic visit to Minneapolis-St. Paul. Minnesota Public Radio providing that coverage throughout the afternoon and early evening today. We'll stay with it, in fact, until the Gorbachev plane leaves sometime around 8 o'clock tonight. He goes on to San Francisco and from there back to the Soviet Union. I'd like to find out from our commentators here what they think about, what will the reaction be in the Soviet Union to Gorbachev's entire trip, the summit as well as this trip to Minnesota and later on California. Patty?
Many people will probably be concerned with much more immediate things. They will be worried about the possibility that they may lose their job in the immediate future. They will probably be worried about getting some food for next week. And this visit will probably have little significance for them.
Mm-hmm. Patty Deal, Evelyn Davenheiser, do you agree with that?
Well, the young high school student we heard from in Duluth wasn't that far from the mark. I think there is an element of Soviet society that probably does see the Gorbachev trip as something that the president's doing when he ought to be tending to problems at home. There is still a strain of isolationism, the sort of xenophobic elements of Soviet society that we've seen in the past. What's different today is that strain of Soviet society, that strain of Soviet political life is much less dominant than it has been in the past. But there's still, your average worker and peasant in the Soviet Union who thinks that we should look inwards, put the food on the shelves, and Gorbachev's not going to be able to do that by coming to the United States. He'd be better off staying home.
One other thing I want to get to before we move on here from you folks, Patty Deal and Evelyn Davenheiser. Patty from the from St. Olaf College and Evelyn from the University of Minnesota, both are political scientists who specialize in the Soviet Union. We were talking just a few seconds before we went on the air about the fact there's a lot of pessimism in the United States about Gorbachev, about the Soviet Union, that they're teetering on the brink of disaster, that Gorbachev is just about a dead horse, and so on. What do you think about that, Patty?
I think you identified correctly. It's too pessimistic. Yes, there is much political turmoil in the Soviet Union, but Gorbachev is a very skillful politician, and he is in a very secure institutional position. He's not in the same position that his predecessors were, namely dependent upon the support and compliance of his colleagues in the Politburo. He is in a constitutionally guaranteed position of president and will be in that position for another 4 years. Gorbachev is like a man in a kayak going through white water. It's a rough ride.
Yeah.
But he's a skillful boatsman.
And he is still in command at this point. Patty Deal and Evelyn Davenheiser are political commentators during this trip by President Gorbachev to Minnesota. We'll be checking back with them in just a little bit. Why Minnesota is the question asked by a lot of people when it was announced that Gorbachev would indeed come here. State officials who helped arrange details of the visit have some insight on that count. One is Richard Bohr, Director of International Trade for the Minnesota Trade Office. I spoke with him a little while ago and asked him to explain the Minnesota connection with the Soviet Union.
I think, Bob, there are two reasons. The first is that he personally has intimate knowledge of the economics and the personalities of Minnesota. And so one of the things he wants to do is to pay his own personal respects to the people of a state that he believed, as do many other Soviets, stood by the Soviet Union, particularly during those very tough years of trade in the late 1970s and early 1980s during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. That occupation, of course, triggered a very serious American trade embargo against the Soviets, and companies like Control Data hung in there with their Soviet colleagues. Also, Bob, the trading relationship, which has developed over almost 30 years, going back to 1963, with those, as you'll remember, those early grain shipments from by Cargill, and the early activities of Control Data, Honeywell, and 3M. Those trade relations have developed over the years. And the day he arrives in Minnesota, is the day that we will have no less than 50 Minnesota companies either selling to the Soviet Union or doing some form of joint venture across that entire economic spectrum, from grain to medicine to computers, that is so critical to Mr. Gorbachev's modernization program.
Now, what did you in the Minnesota Trade Office have to do with either bringing him here or helping to set his schedule while he is here?
Well, Bob, of course, as the arm of state government that assists primarily medium and small-sized businesses in the state to promote international trade, we have been very active not only with our traditional markets, but with new markets as well. You and I have talked before about the significant trade relationship that has developed over the last 10 years with China. And the Soviet Union also has been a major focus of the Minnesota Trade Office as we seek to get Minnesota companies into a market that is not as easy for them, say, as Canada. So we've had a lot of familiarity with the types of business. We've assisted a number of Minnesota companies, and so it's been very natural for us to work on the trade and economic side of Mr. Gorbachev's agenda. And our charge, Bob, has been to make suggestions very early on about how to portray the rich diversity of Minnesota's economy to Mr. Gorbachev and his colleagues.
Why did he ultimately wind up not making a big public appearance, as I know the governor had wanted, and certainly a lot of people would have been interested in hearing him give a speech on the steps of the Capitol, for example?
Oh, you're right. We could have filled that Capitol Mall, as you know, with 500,000 people, and they would have come out, and they would have been waiting for days before, I suspect. But it seems to me that President Gorbachev recognizes that he runs a risk of getting too much praise, too much adulation outside of the Soviet Union when the situation, particularly the economic situation and the ethnic violence within the Soviet Union, is causing so many of his citizens such dire problems. And so I think it's a question of balance.
What do you think Gorbachev's personal appearance in Minnesota will gain for him and for Minnesota that could not have been accomplished by contacts at lower levels of government and within business?
I think that gets to the second reason, Bob, going back to your very first question about why Minnesota. I think President Gorbachev is coming to Minnesota not only to pay tribute to the old friends here in the state who have endured and grown this trade relationship and the cultural and educational exchange over the last three decades, but also to herald a new chapter in that trading relationship. And you know, Bob, for Minnesota, it could be an enormously beneficial relationship, both for Minnesota and the Soviet Union. One of the issues on the agenda in Washington, D.C., as you know, is the trade question. Will the United States government push to extend most favored nation trade status to the Soviet Union? As you know, we've had a very constricted trade relationship with the Soviets, particularly since the 1950s. The tariffs on Soviet imports into the United States are 10 times what they are for most other nations. And so it's very difficult for the Soviets to export their goods into the United States to earn foreign exchange for those goods so that they can buy more things from states like Minnesota. So we hope that his coming to Minnesota endorses his hope that Minnesota will have an increasingly important role to play in the Soviet economic modernization, and that once federal policy allows most favored nation status to go through, as the Cold War wanes and export restrictions, particularly on high technology from the United States, go down, Minnesota will be able to export even more of what it exports best, and that is in the manufactured area, primarily high technology, which is what the Soviets critically need.
Richard Bohr, Director of International Trade for the Minnesota Trade Office, and we'll be hearing more from him a little bit later on in our broadcast. Live coverage of President Gorbachev's visit to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area here on Minnesota Public Radio this afternoon. Let's go up to the state capitol area briefly. Gary Eichen is standing by on the mobile telephone up there. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Bob.
Well, what's it like? Last time we checked in with you about an hour ago, there weren't very many people, and it was awfully cold.
It's still cold, and there still aren't very many people. I was interested in Mr. Bohr's comments, you know, that had he given a speech here, he being Mr. Gorbachev, why the place would have been jammed for days in advance. It isn't jammed today yet, although the crowd is starting to pick up. Interestingly enough, if the motorcade were to swing by here right now, about all Mr. Gorbachev would see would be people who are mad at him for some reason or other.
Is that right?
That's right, and or at least mad at the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. There were a few people, though, we talked to who came out specifically because they're concerned that the only people that Gorbachev will see are people who are unhappy about something. In fact, some of the first people here have been sitting here now for, well, since about 10 o'clock this morning, and they said, well, gee, we're worried that he'll think everybody hates him.
Mm-hmm.
So they came out. There's a woman here from Greensboro, North Carolina, for Pete's sake.
I'll be darned. How about that? Are they all dressed pretty warmly? I mean, I think you could almost wear a parka out there today.
It's definitely parka weather. This reminds me a lot of the Twins parade.
That's right. You were broadcasting up at the Capitol that day too, and it was beastly cold.
It was pretty chilly then. interestingly enough, it's just surprising to me that there aren't more people here. Now again, it is cold, but. Mm-hmm. You know, given the historic nature of it, it's surprising.
Well, it's also early in the schedule in terms of when that motorcade is supposed to swing by the Capitol area. I don't think they're, you know, under the old schedule, I don't think they were supposed to do that until about an hour from now at the earliest.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a good 15, 20 minutes behind schedule as it is. Now, I would assume at some point, Gary, they're going to begin blocking that area off, aren't they?
Well, they have all the streets blocked out.
They do.
You can't drive around up here. And in fact, they kind of look at you suspiciously if you walk around on the streets up around the Capitol. But you can still get around walking, but no driving, and they're pretty much ready to go if the motorcade were to come by. But of course, as you say, that's not going to happen for at least an hour, hour and a half.
Yeah, right. Okay, Gary, well, stay warm and check back with us when you have something.
Having a great time, Bob.
Terrific.
Bye.
Gary Eichen at the state capitol, waiting for that motorcade, which should be by there in an hour, hour and a quarter, something like that. Light rain and 48 degrees now in the Twin Cities, with the wind gusting from the northwest up to 37 miles per hour. Umbrellas won't do you much good today. You better wear a rain suit or something like that if you're going to be outdoors. The folks up at the governor's mansion on Summit Avenue, across the street from it, Karen Boros and Catherine Winter are standing by. They're on a porch, and they are out of the rain.
Hello, Bob. I'm on the porch. Karen's out in the yard where she's got a little better vantage point, and I have just collared our hostess. Diane Fulmer has been kind enough to let us take over a half of her porch and is here with us now. And I wanted to ask you, Ms. Fulmer, have you found this afternoon that you have a lot more friends than you thought you did?
Well, we certainly have all our friends and relatives in one place. About 70 people going in and out off the porch and trying to get the best vantage point from a window or from a post in front of the house, standing on the porch, railing, whatever. We're all trying to catch a glimpse of Mr. Gorbachev when he comes by.
Have you become an overnight celebrity? You and your husband had your door hammered down by media folks like us.
We've talked to a number of media, but that's an exciting part of it. We don't have a visitor like that very often, so we're all a part of watching and telling people about it.
What about living across from the governor's mansion? Do you get a lot of this kind of thing happening, or this must be the biggest thing?
This is definitely the largest event we've had here.
Do you see odd comings and goings over there?
Well, we see comings and goings. Certainly there are occasions when the red carpet is rolled out, and so that's our clue in the neighborhood that there is something happening at the governor's residence. And now and again we see Mr. and Mrs. Perepich out for a walk.
Well, we certainly feel like the red carpet has been rolled out for us here, and we thank you for letting us use your porch and for being with us.
It's a delight to have you. I appreciate your coverage, and I wish you the best.
Great, thank you.
Okay, Catherine, thank you. Catherine Winter reporting live right across the street from the governor's mansion, where President Gorbachev and the motorcade will be arriving within not too many minutes from now. Last report we had, they were on about Interstate 94 and Snelling Avenue. So they'll probably be going down Snelling to the Marion Street exit, I would suspect, and hopping off and going up Summit Avenue that way. Although, I'm not sure. I'm just guessing. That's what I do. Let's check in with Chris Roberts, who is in the crowd somewhere along Summit Avenue on the cellular telephone. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Bob. Actually, I'm not in a crowd. I'm in a hedge right now. I'm trying to block the wind so that you can hear me okay.
Right.
It's really blustery out here. The weather has been bad, as we've been saying all along, but people are really starting to gather now. It's a colorful entourage of folks lined up on Summit Avenue. I'm near Chatsworth and Summit, which is about a half block away from the governor's mansion, and we see people coming down from Summit to coming, I guess it would be westward from Summit, and I would imagine that there's some spillover from Grand old days.
Well, Chris, I was going to ask you about that. Have you been over one block to Grand Avenue? How's the turnout for Grand old day?
Definitely turnout is down compared to previous years, but
yeah.
A surprising amount of people showed up, and a lot of them said that the weather was too bad and they weren't going to venture over a block. They were going to get home, but the weather was a lot worse back then. There's no rain now. It's just windy, and I think a lot of people are coming over.
All right. As far as you can tell, now, Gary was saying that there are a number of people there who appear to be protesting something about the Gorbachev.
There's a lot of groups here. On one end of the governor's mansion, there is a group of Muslim students from the University of Minnesota. Across the street from them, there are people representing the Baltic states, and I think I hear cheers. Somebody's coming along. And across the street from me right now, we have the first bus full of police coming here, and they're getting a lot of cheers for some reason. But across the street from me right now, the Laotian and Cambodian group that Gary was referring to have made it all the way up here. They walked from the Capitol all the way up there, and they have their signs out. And actually, it's kind of funny. Right now, not too far away from me, is a gentleman leaning against a tree on stilts. He is dressed as Uncle Sam, and he is carrying a Soviet flag with a sickle and hammer. So he's
all
getting
right.
a few cheers as well.
Okay, very good. Chris Roberts, who is along Summit Avenue there, as the motorcade is definitely getting in range of the governor's mansion. Commentators Patty Dale and Evelyn David Heiser. Evelyn, all these people who are protesting the Gorbachev trip in one way or another, how well represented are they in the Soviet Union? That is, how much of this protest is legitimate?
Well, certainly the movement for independence in the Baltic republics is a real issue in the Soviet Union right now. Although, what is it, I understand that we've got more Estonians and Latvians out today and fewer Lithuanians, which is probably the opposite of the picture in the Soviet Union. Lithuania has gone much further in the move toward independence than any of the other two. It's a much more homogeneous population.
Mm-hmm. Evelyn David Heiser, let's go back to Catherine Winter on the porch at Summit Avenue. And apparently the motorcade is just about pulling up. Is that right, Catherine?
It certainly looks like it. Two loads of police cars and now a bunch of other... There were two busloads of police officers, I should say. And now the motorcade appears to be pulling in. I believe reporter Karen Boros, who's out on the lawn here with a microphone, has a slightly better vantage point. Karen, what can you see from there?
Well, I can see at least one of the Soviet automobiles here, the first one to arrive. A carload of what appeared to be Secret Service people pulled up and dispatched about six people who ran back toward the gate. The bell ringers are lined up. The helicopters are circling. I think we're close.
It appears to me from the live video feed that we are getting that Gorbachev actually got out of his limousine shortly before it would have been ready to pull up to the governor's mansion there and probably stepped out and shook a few hands in
that's
the crowd.
There's a bunch of Secret Service people running on the corner. I think it's Oxford and Summit up there. I think that's where a group of protesters were assembled up there along with a group you know, a group of normal Twin Cities folks, if there is such a thing. I can see a crowd down there now.
The Secret Service took off down there, Bob, with their ties flying at a run, so it seems as though something unexpected must have happened.
Well, that most likely is it, that Gorbachev got out of the motorcade. I wonder, Evelyn, is he, when he does that sort of thing, does he have a translator with him so that people can understand him, or does he just shake their hand? And, you know, I think anybody can figure out if a guy is saying, well, hi, how are you, nice to be here. It doesn't matter what language that is, really.
When he wanders deep into the crowd, I think his translator gets lost in the shuffle. He does have his trusty interpreter who's with him on all these visits to the United States, and whom we also see when Baker Bush meets Gorbachev outside of the United States. If you notice, the man always close by Gorbachev, bald on top, like Gorbachev, with a mustache, a younger man.
Yeah, that's the interpreter.
That's the interpreter.
Uh-huh. Does Gorbachev have any English?
Not really. I mean, he knows a word now and then. He's been known to say hello.
Because I know that there are some of these world leaders who actually do speak quite good English but decline to do so because they figure, well, they're kind of in a formal circumstance and they're better to stick with the interpretation.
Yeah. Gorbachev is not an English speaker.
Bob, if we can break in at this point.
Indeed, Catherine.
It looks as though the limousine is pulling up. The bell ringers have started playing their bells from here. Karen, what can you see from down there?
I can see the limo and a crowd of Secret Service type people, I see a limo down there. And as you say, the bell ringers are doing what they do. The limousine is pulling up right now at the front walking gate of the Capitol as opposed to the driveway gate.
Bob, we don't know if you can hear these bells, but what you have is a long row of people in white blouses and black trousers or skirts playing large golden bells rhythmically. It's actually very pretty, and the limo is very slowly sliding into place here.
And that appears to be Governor Perpich walking there. Yeah, Governor Perpich is...
It's a large motorcade. I know from what Stephen Smith was saying earlier that there are about 40 vehicles in the motorcade altogether, with, of course, the governor and Gorbachev and his wife in the first of the vehicles. But there are an awful lot of vehicles in the motorcade, and so it may take some time for all of them to get in place there.
And there's quite a lot of activity. A lot of people now running down the sidewalk here who are up at the corner.
Either end of the street, huge crowds of people pressing against what looks like snow fence. Very colorful, packed-in crowds, pointing
fence.
Cameras.
Now,
well, not anymore. Now it's double-duty cyclone fence.
Who's he actually going to be having this meal with?
Oh, it's an enormous guest list.
Okay, the governor and Lola Perpich are walking through the gates right now. Lola Perpich wearing a yellow suit, for what it's worth.
People are running down the street from houses to get a look
at... And there's a large crowd of people coming through, and I think television cameras...
These must be the press pool people.
No, I think this in the middle of that might be Gorbachev, because when television photographers hold their cameras up in the air at arm's length, they only do it when something or someone...
When there's something to take a picture of.
Right. Because those things are heavy.
It is a thick crowd, Bob. It's not a tidy line of people. It's a thick cluster of people going through the gate at the governor's mansion, which has been done up with festoons of greenery, and there is some red carpet, which you can't see anymore because there's all kinds of people on it.
They're trying to make it look spring-like, even though the weather is anything
right.
But. Mm-hmm. I see a number of people dressed in slickers out there as they await the... arrival.
There have been a lot of people here in slickers for a long time, standing up on the risers here, getting rained on. It is not really raining right now, but still blustery, cold, and very cloudy.
You're talking a little... I was asking you just a little bit about the guest list for lunch.
Mm-hmm. Karen, do you know something about who is on that list?
I don't think they have released a list of luncheon guests. As I understand it, the luncheon guests were not all finalized until the very end. We might find out after the luncheon who got to sit at the governor and governor's table here.
We did receive a press release about the luncheon, and it did not include the names of those invited. It just included what they're going to eat, and it talked a little about
China
the bell.
patterns and
right,
table
China
cloths.
Patterns from Dayton's and crystal from Dayton's.
Okay, how many? There's a large crowd of people headed in the front door
sure,
now.
Sure, and I see Gorbachev
and
there.
I see, yes.
Right,
and,
he on the television feed, I see him
yes.
going in. How many people can they serve in the governor's residence there?
The governor's table in the dining room seats 18 people, and I think they were talking about an additional 30, maybe 50, 55 to 60 total who will be dining here.
Mm-hmm. Gorbachev has just waved and now is turning to go inside, I believe. As you know, we're across the street. It's not a terrific vantage point. It's certainly better than a lot of people have. We are about, we're across two lawns and on the other side of the street standing on a porch, so.
I want to ask Patty Dale about those limousines that we're seeing. They're quite some vehicle, aren't they?
They must represent one of the rarest motor vehicles in the world. It's my understanding that they are handmade and only five are made per year. That makes them much more rare than, say, a Rolls-Royce. They are very, very heavy. As you mentioned earlier, yes, they must get a very low gas mileage. And their use is confined to members of the Soviet Politburo.
Not even the heads of industry get to use them, is that right?
Right, because there is a second level of vehicle, the Chaika.
Ah, yes.
And so members of the Central Committee.
And what would the ordinary Soviet citizen drive if, in fact, he or she is lucky enough to have a car?
There's the Zhiguli, which is a Fiat 124 built in Togliattigrad in a factory made by the Fiat company in the late 1960s. That factory has never been retooled, even though Fiat's own plants in northern Italy have been retooled at least five times.
So they're basically turning out a late 1960s vehicle in 1990.
With 1960s equipment. And yes. This is a good illustration of the problem of Soviet industry, that recapitalization and technological innovation have both been neglected.
And what would a Soviet worker pay for a vehicle like that? In terms of the number of weeks or months it would take him to earn the amount of money to buy the car.
My memory is saying to me 18,000 rubles for a new Zhiguli, but I will stand correction. But if you have to put that money up front, and then you have to wait perhaps 12 or 18 months before you obtain delivery.
So no buying on credit and no special orders from the factory?
Indeed not.
Uh-huh. But if you think about the situation for consumer durables in the Soviet Union, what seems like a very high figure in terms of how long a worker has to work to save the money for a car, it is indeed a long time. But the savings is not a terrible burden on the worker and his family, because consumer goods are in such scarce supply that there really isn't anything that he's dying to go spend the money on in the meantime. So
sure.
That money piles up without trouble. And the old joke about buying a car in the Soviet Union went, worker goes to the car manufacturer and says, you know, I want the car. Okay, comrade, you can have it in 2 years and such and such a day. And the worker says, shall I pick it up in the morning or the afternoon? And the guy says, why does it matter? And he says, the plumber's coming in the morning. So this is very
right.
Typical of
yes, and I agree with Evelyn. And, you know, we also need to point out that to date, Soviet citizens have had to pay very little for the necessities of life, rent and food.
Yeah.
Now, this is going to change under Perestroika.
In fact, haven't the prices of a lot of goods doubled? Food has doubled and
yes,
other things?
But, mm-hmm. I mean, when you consider that the price of some commodities, even doubled, is still very cheap. So the regular price for a loaf of bread used to be 15 kopecks. That, depending upon what exchange rate you use, it's somewhere between 5 and 10 cents. You can ride anywhere in Moscow for 5 kopecks. That's perhaps a penny. And Soviet citizens are now very concerned about these subsidies being withdrawn. because they're used to them and because they cannot readily envisage what it's going to be like to have to pay market prices.
Isn't there also a concern among the Soviet workers that the job that they have isn't necessarily going to be guaranteed to them anymore?
Well, that's been a big problem. Part of the whole Brezhnev era was to provide the worker with a great deal of security. If you marketize the economy, if you try to encourage efficiency for enterprises by allowing enterprises to go out of business, you're allowing enterprises to lay off, fire, what have you, the workers.
Sure.
Not only is it a matter of guaranteeing workers jobs, in many cases it's a matter of guaranteeing workers the job that they have. Housing often comes along with a job. Housing is built by the enterprise for
Karen,
some of the larger factories.
Do you think we should get one of those people?
So this is extremely problematic for the workers. There hasn't been a very strong social welfare net in the Soviet Union. On the one hand, prices have been very low, subsidized, housing is guaranteed for what it's worth. It costs only a tenth of one's income. But there haven't been very good means for paying unemployment benefits, for retraining workers.
Mm-hmm. Commentators Evelyn David Heiser from the University of Minnesota, a political scientist, and Patty Dale, who is a political scientist at St. Olaf College and director of Soviet studies there. You're listening to live coverage of President Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to the Twin Cities, our coverage made possible by the international public relations consulting firm of Padilla Spear Beardsley. President Gorbachev and his entourage are now at the governor's mansion on Summit Avenue in St. Paul, presumably sitting down to a rather elegant lunch, which reporter Catherine Winter described to us a little while ago, a lot of things that certainly are beyond my capacity to pronounce. But let's go back out there to Summit Avenue and see what's going on. Catherine?
Well, actually, Bob, there's a pretty big protest going on directly in front of the governor's mansion. Karen Boros has pulled aside one of the people demonstrating and is with him now out on the front lawn of the mansion where we're staying.
Catherine, George Jace is with me, along with his flag of Lithuania. And I guess my question to you is, what do you want to Gorbachev to walk away from this with?
I'd like Gorbachev to know there are a lot of Lithuanian and Baltic state people here asking him to recognize their quest for independence.
What, Governor Perpich has said that he will not press this issue when he meets with Gorbachev. Do you think that's a mistake on Perpich's part?
Oh, obviously. That's an issue that everybody's skirting. Bush skirted it, apparently, at Camp David also, along with the German Unified Nation. I mean, let's talk about it. Let's get it out. We've got to have that issue aired. We've got to get it resolved.
Logistically, what did you guys have to do to get your flags in here and yourselves in here? This must not have been an easy task.
Well, it wasn't really all that difficult. I think the weather had a lot to play with it, but we just parked two blocks away, came over. We've had some meetings. We've had 2 or 3 weeks of meetings, and we've got about 500 people here, and they're all with their flags and with their placards.
Okay. Tell me about some of the other flags. I see a yellow and blue flag, a maroon and white flag. Which flags are those?
Okay. There's four nationalities. There's the Latvians, the Estonians, Lithuanians, and Ukrainians have a large contingent also.
Okay. And I think the Afghanis are up on the corner also.
The Afghanis are vocal. We are making our message by our flags and our respect for the flag.
What are you going to do when he comes out?
Well, actually, I'm heading on the way to the Capitol right now. I think that's a place where we're going to get some visibility once again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Thank you for coming up here in the yard and chatting with us.
Good luck.
Catherine?
Okay, thanks, Karen. Right now, there are more people than I had expected would be able to get onto this street, which has been cordoned off. The sidewalk in front is thronged with people. Some of them have signs. There's a sign in front of me, the Soviet Union, an idea whose time has gone. Most of the people who are going to the luncheon appear to have filtered into the governor's mansion at this point, and there are not many still out on the governor's lawn. So the people who are milling around here are primarily people either who live in the area or who have managed to get onto the street anyway. So Right now, everybody's inside the mansion as near as we can tell.
All right, Catherine. I wonder if Senator Boschwitz might be hanging around out there somewhere. And if you happen to run into him, why, you might get a chance to visit with him for a little bit, too.
I should explain, Bob, that because of where we're situated, in order to get up onto the porch of this mansion, we had to leave the cordoned off area and we're not permitted to re-enter it. So we will try and get a hold of people, but our chances became very dim once we came up here.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot, Catherine. Catherine Winter reporting from the governor's, from across the street at the governor's mansion, where they should be sitting down to that rather dynamic luncheon here in just a couple of seconds. Chris Tetlin is in downtown Minneapolis on a cellular telephone across the street from the Radisson Plaza Hotel. What's going on down there now, Chris?
Well, Bob, they've actually moved me around the corner. The police have sealed off the block right around the hotel very tight and get kind of surly if you get very close to it at all. A lot of cars are starting to arrive, Jaguars, BMWs, a few limousines. They move by quickly enough that I am not sure who it is, but they are important folks arriving for the business meeting already. They're the only vehicles that are moving down the street toward the hotel. Some folks, spectators, are beginning to gather, although unlike the scene in St. Paul so far, there's nobody here who it looks anything but happy at the prospect of seeing Mr. Gorbachev. No protesters yet, but intrepid people already beginning to gather in downtown Minneapolis.
Any indication that some of those business leaders who are going to meet with Gorbachev have begun to show up yet?
Yeah, that's what my guess is. That's what all of the long, big cars that are moving down the block to the hotel are. There are some folks getting out of those cars there a block away, as close as anyone like me can get. But I'm sure they're the only folks the Secret Service people are letting by.
Well, I doubt that Roger Smith will be arriving in a Zill. I have a feeling he'll be driving something else.
I think it's a good guess.
All right, thanks, Chris. Chris Tetlin, who's down at Minneapolis Radisson Plaza Hotel. The meeting with the business leaders gets underway a bit later, apparently according to the earlier schedule, sometime around 5 o'clock or thereabouts. It's our understanding that is going to be available for live broadcast, and if it is, we certainly will bring that to you. Minnesota Public Radio canceling its regularly scheduled programming this afternoon so we can broadcast live the historic trip by President Mikhail Gorbachev to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Lunch at the governor's mansion, that is the item of business right now. Following that, a motorcade tour down Summit Avenue and around the Capitol area, then to downtown Minneapolis, the meeting with the business leaders. They move on from there later this evening to the farm in Farmington, Minnesota, then back up to Control Data headquarters in Bloomington at around 7:30, and then departing by airport for San Francisco at around 8 o'clock or a little thereafter. Any visit by a head of state obviously attracts quite a gaggle of groupies, press, and other hangers-on. Now, John Chancellor fits only one of those categories. He is a member of the press. But it isn't only President Gorbachev's visit which attracted John Chancellor's attention. Chancellor is on a book tour, which happened to bring him through Minnesota just as Gorbachev came as well. So I used the opportunity to talk with television commentator and veteran journalist John Chancellor, who offered a brand new theory as to why Gorbachev is visiting today.
Well, when I'm fascinated by the schedule, and I hope they've changed it a little bit while he's here. When I heard that he was coming to Minneapolis, I said, now why Minneapolis and St. Paul? And I thought, aha, I know. It's the skyways. I've lived in Russia for 2 years, and I lived for two Russian winters in Moscow. And they are very comparable to the winters you have here in the Twin Cities. But Minneapolis and St. Paul have learned how to cope with those winters better, it seems to me, than any snowbelt city in the world. Therefore, I said, smart old Gorby is coming here to have a look at the skyways. And at those big atria you have with the trees growing in them and this wonderful and, I think, unique contribution that Minneapolis has made to snowbelt architecture. And there are a lot of cities in the Soviet Union that would benefit from these relatively inexpensive. They're imaginative. They're not expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he doesn't get into a skyway, I think he's missing the best part of the trip.
Well, he's going to be meeting with a number of business leaders and agriculture leaders in an effort to do something about his economy, which is really in bad shape. What do you think the prospects are over there?
I think we are truly in a situation now where no one knows. Where the economists at the KGB do not really know. I get a sense of free fall not just in the economic indicators, but in their understanding of what the next political development may be. And I think that you've got to keep your eye on Boris Yeltsin and the, as we call it, the RSFSR, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, the Russian Republic. He is already challenging the central authority in some fascinating ways, one of which was his demand that republic law in the Russian Republic take precedence over Soviet law in domestic matters, civil suits, things like that. I don't know where they're going. My guess is that Gorbachev doesn't know where they're going. Shevardnadze, Yakovlev, all of that crowd do not know where they're going. I thought they were pretty well put together for the first 4 years, say, or 3 years of perestroika and glasnost. And then we realized we got very little perestroika restructuring, an enormous amount of glasnost, openness.
Mm-hmm.
I think more glasnost than they could be comfortable with myself. And yet not an end of, and the panic buying in the stores and all of that. So I used to say 50-50 on Gorbachev's chances. I now think you ought to amend that if you're thinking about it to say simply, nobody knows.
Mm-hmm. What about U.S. relations with the Soviet Union? How do you see those changing over the next 10 years or so?
Well, I think we have to solve the problem of Germany before we can get the problem of Soviet-American relations in place. Remember, it's only about 350 miles across Poland from the western German border to the eastern German border to the west part of the Soviet Union. They think that's really pretty close. They remember the war more than we remember the war. They took a far heavier hit in the Second World War than we did. And so I must say I have a lot of sympathy for Russians who say we've got to make sure that the Germans don't come again. And that's, after all, why they set up the buffer states in Eastern Europe. So that what they're arguing now, it seems to me, is for some big, vague kind of Europe in which United Germany would be a big, vague kind of part. And I don't think that's going to fly. But yet I also share Gorbachev's apprehension of having to go to his own people, who may someday be actual voters, and say Germany is going to stay in NATO, because they think NATO is aimed at them. And so we've got a lot of sorting out to do on that.
Do you think the Cold War, per se, is finished with?
Yeah, I think the Cold War, I don't think you can get that toothpaste back in the tube. And one of the great reasons, I think, is glasnost, and the fact is that I think the Poles and the Czechs and the Hungarians and the East Germans would probably fight to the last person if the Soviet Army tried to become the hegemonic power there again. So I don't think you've got a new Eastern Europe, and I think you have a new Soviet Union, and therefore, what we're going to have to do, I think, in this country is tailor our defense spending to the needs of the 1990s and beyond, which are low-intensity conflicts in other parts of the world. And I think we need to retool. I'm not sure we need all the battleships. I do know that I don't think we should worry as much as we used to worry about tank armies rolling across the North German plain. I'd worry about the Middle East now more than I would about the North German plain.
What do we do about the nuclear threat, not from the Soviet Union, but from renegade states that could somehow develop the technology and use it if they wanted?
I don't really know, Bob, what you do about that. I don't think that the Strategic Defense Initiative is likely to be an effective shield on that. Let's take Colonel X in Country Y, who develops a missile that could hit the United States, and suddenly we find that Colonel X can put a nuclear warhead on it, and everybody runs around the United States saying the sky is falling. Why don't we have the strategic defense shield over the United States so that this buccaneer can't land a nuclear weapon on the White House? Well, the fact is that nuclear weapons can be fit into the trunk of a Volkswagen. And if Colonel X really wants to be a threat to the United States, SDI isn't going to keep him out. He can bring that stuff in here, and we import, I don't know how many tons of drugs every day in this country. A really determined terrorist could get a nuclear weapon right here in the Twin Cities, if they wanted to, in a suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we are going to live in that connection in an increasingly dangerous world.
One final question for you, John Chancellor. What do you see as the prospects for trade between the United States and the Soviet Union, specifically between trade with this part of the United States in the Minnesota, the upper Midwest area?
I think you're still going to have large grain sales to them. I think we all would like to see their agriculture improve. I mean, I think because the agriculture, the problems they have, destabilizes that country. And we're going to have to go through a period where what you have now, I think, is you've got the Soviet Union that is a country that is flat broke but heavily armed. It's the second or the leading nuclear power in the world. I think it's second. And it doesn't have any money. And that's a dangerous combination, it seems to me. And so that I think you will still, as they restructure the economy, you will still have grain sales to the Soviet Union. I would hope someday to see them, and I think Minnesota farmers ought to think about this, and the upper Middle West ought to think about this, that if they work it right, they will not need large amounts of American grain. We're going to have to find other markets for it. And we're going to have to say to ourselves in a practical way, that's the best outcome. The worst outcome would be to perpetuate what we have now in this flat, broke, heavily armed Soviet Union. And sure, it's nice to sell the grain, but I'd much rather have a Russia more or less on its feet than one tottering around with hands full of nuclear weapons.
John Chancellor, who is in the Twin Cities promoting his new book called Peril and Promise. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Bob.
12 minutes now before 3 o'clock. Our live coverage of President Gorbachev's visit to the Twin Cities area continues. He and Governor Perpich are at the governor's residence on Summit Avenue right now. Presumably they have begun and are working their way through a multi-course luncheon. I would suspect that the Gorbachev party is rather happy to have that lunch since they arrived late and lost an hour, rather gained an hour, when they moved from the Eastern into the Central time zone. The reporters Catherine Winter and Karen Boris are across the street from the governor's mansion on Summit Avenue. They've been chatting with a number of people who have stopped by. Catherine, what do you have there?
Well, Bob, a couple of things. Most of the people in suits, the important people in suits, have gone inside the buildings now, as we mentioned before. But apparently what has happened on either end of this street is that the cyclone fences come down. And so on this side of the street, the opposite side from the governor's mansion, there are about a zillion people on the sidewalk and crowding up onto people's lawns. Some of them have even brought chairs with them and are sitting in them. Reporter Karen Boros is in the front yard of the mansion from which we're broadcasting, and she has with her someone who was apparently in the crowd when President Gorbachev stopped his limousine. Is that right, Karen?
That is right. Dane Richter of Minneapolis got here at 11:30 this morning because he wanted to be able to have a chance to see Gorbachev. And I guess you were up on that corner at Oxford and Summit. What happened?
Well, someone had spread a rumor that he had gotten out of the car around Lexington or earlier, and all of a sudden, I look around, and there was a large group of protesters on the other side of the street, and they had been chanting for most of the morning. And I looked around, and there was Gorbachev, and he went directly up to the protesters, the group, and he started shaking hands with them. And then he walked down Summit for a little while, and on the side of the street I was standing, he walked over to the side I was standing on, and he waved to the crowd from there, and he continued on his way.
So that he arrived at the governor's mansion on foot, do you think?
Yes, he arrived on foot. He walked the two blocks of Summit, just walked it, while everyone else rode in their cars.
What was the crowd doing at that point where you were?
Well, there was a barricade. There was a barricade up for where some reporters were standing. And when Gorbachev started walking down the street, they started to crowd the fence so no one could see. So that the barricade was that was brought down, and the people just walked up and behind the reporters and watched Gorbachev walk at the same time.
What did the protesters do when he walked up to them?
They turned silent, and I couldn't hear them. I didn't hear them chanting anymore. I don't know if Gorbachev spoke to them but I could see that he was shaking hands with them with his. Normal security people around him, but he shook hands and then he walked down Summit towards the governor's mansion.
So you got your wish. You got here earlier and you got to see what you came to see. What do you do now?
Well, I probably just stay around here and see what's going to happen next, and maybe see if there's another chance that he'll be coming down the street again.
Okay, thank you. That is Dane Richter of Minneapolis, who got here early, got a good seat, and got to see what he came to see. Catherine, another thing that we've talked a little bit about the menu. One of the items on the menu is veal, and the veal protesters are here now.
Oh, are they?
Holding up a sign in protest of the use of veal in the menu.
See, I'd like to know that. I understand that walleye is one of the items on the menu there.
That's right. It's a pecan-breaded walleye. The menu features a Minnesota specialties, and of course walleye would be one of them.
Yeah, but now wait a minute here.
Where are the walleye protesters?
Well, no, not walleye protesters, but you know, walleye, that would have to be a walleye caught by a recreational fisherman, because there's no commercial walleye fishing in Minnesota, is there?
Isn't that interesting? You know, I have no idea where the walleye came from. Perhaps it came from spearfishers.
Other thing it would be a frozen Canadian walleye.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
My prediction early on was that they would serve some of the fish from the ore pits in Chisholm,
right.
You know, giving the governor a chance to boost his hometown area. But
sure.
those ore pit fish apparently lost out to the to the walleye.
I've been told now authoritatively that it is a Red Lake Indian Reservation walleye.
So isn't that interesting?
There we are. That's where the commercial fishing is done. That's right, Red Lake. It's about the only place I think that can be done now,
mm-hmm.
in the state of Minnesota. All right, ladies, thank you much. Catherine Winter and Karen Boros,
wow.
Across the street from the governor's residence where the luncheon is now taking place. Evelyn Davidhiser, I was interested in the fact that Gorbachev got out of his limousine and talked to the protesters.
It's classic Gorbachev. Try the sugar first. Certainly these protesters aren't a thorn in Gorbachev's side. I mean, if he wants thorny Baltic protesters, he's got them at home. And so why not try a little kindness?
A little positive persuasion
right.
There. Patty Dale, do you think that these apparently spontaneous stops by him are really spontaneous, or are they planned out pretty carefully in advance?
Presumably the location of the stop is not planned in advance, but it's part of his public relations routine. Gorbachev has very definitely cultivated a cult of personality with Western public opinion, and is acting to maintain that.
How does he play in his own country? He was immensely popular to begin with, probably a little less so now. Are the Soviet people tiring of these little stunts of his, so to speak?
Yes, they are. Many Soviet people want to know where's the beef and, you know, where's the food on the table. But I would draw our attention to a recent public opinion survey published by the Soviet journal Aganyok. This is a popular satirical magazine. 25% said that they were worse off. 50% said they felt about the same. 25% said they felt better off. So what is happening in the Soviet Union is that social inequality is increasing. There are winners and there are losers. And the winners are essentially the young, the better educated, and those able to contribute to a technical and consumer revolution. The losers are the older, more infirm, less well-educated. And in that sense, perestroika can be compared with Reaganism and Thatcherism.
Hmm. Patty Dale, who is a political scientist from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, one of our commentators. Evelyn Davidhiser from the University of Minnesota, also political scientist, is with us too. The rise of Boris Yeltsin's political fortunes this week with his election as president of the Russian Republic has captured just about as much media attention as Gorbachev's visit to the United States. Boris Yeltsin has announced that he's willing to strike some agreements with other republics, including Lithuania. There is the perception that Yeltsin is a threat to the political future of Gorbachev. For some illumination of that topic, I spoke with Irina Solotsova, a reporter and editor for Radio Moscow.
Tell me what, the two people have absolutely different obligations. They have, in a sense, even different duties, although Yeltsin is now set for presidency of the Russian Federation, and Mr. Gorbachev, of course, being the president of the entire country. they, by virtue of their position, they are supposed to pursue different interests. Because Mr. Gorbachev, I think, is of course interested in consolidating the country, which is the biggest, probably the toughest task for him right now. Now, what Mr. Yeltsin is trying to do, he is thinking in more limited terms about the future of just one republic, of the Russian Federation. That is a republic big enough to worry anyone. I mean, with over half of the territory of the Soviet Union and over half of its population. But to tell you frankly, I don't think that what Mr. Yeltsin or Mr. Landsbergis is going to do in the next few months is going to be, again, looked upon as a conflict between these people and Mr. Gorbachev. It's rather a problem of the solution of the crisis, of the many crises this country is going through. So if Mr. Yeltsin is going to abide by the rules, meaning by the Constitution, even by the unwritten rules, I think the crisis will be resolved eventually. If he is going to take a tougher stand, like Mr. Landsbergis, who has violated the Constitution repeatedly, I don't think it's going to be constructive for either of the two, for either Mr. Yeltsin or Mr. Gorbachev. It's a matter of consolidation. Now, who has... And one more thing is that Mr. Yeltsin, who is, you know, widely perceived as a... He's met with a very, very mixed response here. To say that he enjoys the overwhelming popularity of the Russian people is probably to say a wrong thing. He's an erratic populist, you know, flamboyant critic who owes his political career and who owes much of his popularity to his radical stand and his criticism when he was in opposition. And he has spent so many years in opposition. But some people think, you know, he really belongs in the opposition and maybe he should have been kept in the opposition. Now that he takes in charge the biggest republic of the Soviet Union, he's going to play a constructive role. At least that's what he's supposed to do, and that is a totally different story. Although he enjoys the popularity among a considerable part of the people here. And right now, he is believed to have quite a strong team behind him, a team of the economists, of politicians who are backing him up. And it is perhaps this team, and not so much Mr. Yeltsin, who is going to bring through the reform, to carry it through in the Russian Federation, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, he is sometimes thought of as a man who probably should have remained in the opposition, but on the other hand, he is perceived as an honest man, you know. And in this country, if you know, this is a very, very important quality. He is perceived as an honest man, a man of integrity, who can, you know, look people in the eye and tell them the truth. And this is something that this country has been lacking for decades, you know. So he probably. His popularity is also due to his personal characteristics.
Irina Solotsova, who is a reporter and editor for Radio Moscow's North American service, and I spoke with her in Moscow by telephone yesterday morning, I believe it was. Our live coverage of President Gorbachev's visit to the Twin Cities is made possible by the international public relations consulting firm of Padilla Spear Beardsley. 3 o'clock is the time, and this is member-supported Minnesota Public Radio. This is KNOW, Minneapolis-St. Paul. In the Twin Cities, light rain 48 degrees, the wind gusting to 37 miles per hour. Broadcasting live, President Gorbachev's trip to the Twin Cities today on Minnesota Public Radio. We have canceled our regularly scheduled programming so that we can bring you live coverage of this historic event.